Okay, well, I am very pleased to introduce you today to our speaker, Jo Allen. Jo Allen is a socialist from the United States. People who were here last night will have perhaps already heard him speak once at this conference. Jo Allen is also a frequent contributor to the International Socialist Review and is actually the author of a fantastic book called Vietnam, The Last Time the US Lost. And it's an examination of the Vietnam War from an anti-war perspective. You can get copies of that book upstairs on our bookstall on level 2, and I strongly encourage people to peruse that bookstall and buy Jo's book. And I'm going to now hand over to Jo to give the talk. Please welcome him.
Thank you. I was warned about this. Can everybody hear me if I speak in this voice? Louder. So I have to like, it's going to be like a union meeting then. Yeah. Don't shut off the microphone on me. I used to be in the Teamsters Union, which is not known for its polite level of discussion. Nor a very sophisticated level either. But it was fun. A friend of mine, Sean Harkin, who people may know here, he's Chicago organizer of the ISO, sent me an email this morning. And sometimes when I get these emails, I wonder, this is a joke, right? And according to the latest polls taken by the Rasmussen Association, which is a fairly, you know, well-respected, long-established polling operation in the United States, 53% of Americans, when given a choice between supporting capitalism or socialism, announced that only 53% supported capitalism. I thought this is a joke, right? I mean, come on, Sean. I mean, this is all you had to do at 4 in the morning was play around with your Firefox print and send me this. When you got underneath the words, and people were asked about free enterprise as opposed to the word capitalism, the support for the free enterprise system went up and socialism went down. And the reason that I start with that is because clearly there's this idea out there that capitalism has really screwed us over and that something called socialism is a good idea. Now, for people who come from countries where socialism as a political tradition is much stronger than it has been in the United States since a period that's called McCarthyism, which is a bit of a misnomer, and if people want to ask me a question about that later, I can answer it. As a historian, I can have my pet peeves about how history is written and how I would do it if I was in charge. But I think, you know, the question is, what does that have to do with Obama? Because for most people outside the United States, I think for a sizable section of the population, is that, of course, people are just happy as hell that Bush is gone. You know, I mean, the last 8 years have been just, I mean, absolute hell for most people. I mean, you know, if you look at life in the United States, for working class people, for people who are Arab, for people who are Muslim, for people who just are struggling to get by, you face incredibly difficult odds. And so there was this massive electoral wave that really swept the Republicans out of power. Like most right-wing parties anywhere, they never really give up, they never really shut up, they never really seem to understand why people threw them out of power, and they keep trying to, you know, claw their way back in. And of course, Obama being the first African-American president of the United States, for most of the world's population that isn't white, this would seem to be an important political event. For many Palestinians and for many Arabs and Muslims around the world, the very fact that the president of the United States, his name is now Barack Hussein Obama, you would think, well, we're going to get a little bit better of a better deal now, aren't we? I mean, it can't be as bad as when the president of the United States' name was George Herbert Walker Bush, right? I mean, it's gotta be a little bit easier, right? And, of course, what I'm going to try to do today is to go over what I think will be, what will continue that will be the same, and what I think is different. And this is where I have to disagree a little bit, I think, with John Pilger. Did anybody get a chance to see him last session? Is where I have to disagree a bit with John, because I don't think you can simply say that Barack Obama is just another American president and that this is simply a continuation of policies that were begun under Reagan and will continue in the same way under Obama. I think that would be a misreading of what is happening politically, but also it would misdirect you if you're a socialist trying to build an alternative in the United States and I think around the globe today. As I was telling comrades last night, how many people were at the opening session last night? Just so I know who I'm... So everybody was there. Okay, so none of my jokes are going to work. As I did tell people, and for those who weren't there, is that, you know, politics ever since Obama's election has really kind of opened up. There's like a breath of fresh air with politics in the United States. In a sense that, you know, for 30 years, and particularly for the last 8 years, it's just a sense that you can't win. I mean, what's the point of organizing? You're always defeated. Or if you're an anti-war or activist, we organize these massive demonstrations. You know, Americans do things big, right? It's always, you know, let's not have a demonstration of 1,000 people. We only can have one of 1,000,000 people. But then you have a demonstration of 1,000,000 people, and it makes no dent in the policies of the government. So you go, so what's the point of organizing demonstrations anyway? I don't know if you've had similar arguments on the Australian anti-war movement. But those sorts of things, the idea that you simply are punching the wall, and the wall's getting stronger, and your hand's getting broken. And I think that's the way that a lot of people felt about politics, particularly the last 8 years. And since Obama's election, there's been a sense that we can make a difference with things, that there's millions of Americans whose first political activity is working for Obama's victory. It's not their last political campaign. It's their first political campaign. And that's important. And part of that means that people are thinking about politics in a very different way, because once people believe that they actually can make a difference, then they actually think that they can actually make a difference in a bigger way. I mean, last Saturday night in Chicago, we organized a forum, which had a couple hundred people at it, that was called, Is the U.S. Headed Toward Socialism? Now, I can safely say, in the 30 years that I've been in politics, we have never organized a meeting like that before. You know, you just don't do that. You know, is a revolution possible in the U.S.? Yes. Why we need a revolutionary party? Yes. Why capitalism sucks? Yes. But are we actually heading towards socialism? If you brought that up in a branch meeting, people would think you're nuts, right? Right? Oh, it's Joe's little pet peeve. We're not going to go for that, are we? We're all sane here, right? And part of this is because Obama's election has meant that there's been, at least initially, and we'll see, this depends on what people do from this point onward, a small, important reintroduction of American-style liberal reform back into American politics. One of the first bills that he signed as president was an Equal Pay Act for women. The gag rule was lifted on any institution that the U.S. gives money to that's involved in Planned Parenthood, for example. You couldn't mention abortion as an option. That's been lifted. There's been a whole series of restrictive executive orders that Bush put through, restricting the rights of public sector trade unions that have been lifted. And in some ways, most importantly, and it's been downplayed, is that the horrible military-like raids from Homeland Security directed at immigrant workers, you know, where they go out to a very remote part of the country, surround a meatpacking plant or a manufacturing facility, surround them with hundreds of Darth Vader-like suited up guys with the most advanced weaponry, take out hundreds of workers, take them to a detention center 100 miles away, and begin the process of deporting them. That, Obama says, is going to come to an end. And if that sticks, that's a huge victory. It was one of the big sticking points for progressive activists in the United States. And, of course, our Republican friends, who never know why, like I said, never know why they lose, never accept their defeat, and get more embarrassing in their isolation, have only responded to many of these policies by unrelentingly attacking Obama as a socialist. Now, I got to give George Bush credit for one thing. In the last 2 months of his administration, those same people were attacking him as a socialist. Okay? You know, they had one of the senators, Inhofe, from Oklahoma, which you'll just give Oklahoma its credit. I mean, it did used to have the largest socialist vote in the United States. It used to be in Oklahoma back in the 19-teens. I mean, just, you know, they're not all bad people. Got up the day that Henry Paulson announced, the former Treasury Secretary announced that they were going to bail out some of the leading banks of the United States. And he got up in front of Congress and he says, My God, I woke up this morning and I thought I was in France. And I'm, you know, you just go, what France are you talking about? I mean, what this imagery of France is, you know, I mean, you just go, what is this? It really captures their imagination. They speak a different language there, you know. You know. But this unrelenting attack on Obama and his administration as a bunch of socialists is important, because what it has meant is that there's been a reinvigoration of a discussion about what socialism means in America to people. So it starts from the right, but it's actually been embraced by millions of people. And I think this is going to have an impact, really, in terms of political discussion all over the world. In fact, one of the things I mentioned last night is that just before I caught the plane here, one of the leading Republicans came out and said that the effect of Obama's stimulus plan, which, remember, is still a majority of his tax cuts for the rich and bailing out the banks with no strings attached, is the final leap towards socialism. You know, which means that, of course, that when I return to the United States, they'll be, you know, welcome back to the People's Republic of America. And they'll say you don't need a passport anymore because the borders are open, right? That's what I'm expecting when I'm going to get home. Now, of course, a lot of this seems to confirm what the Republicans have been saying about Obama for a long time, that he was a secret socialist, right? You know, like the secret Cylons on Battlestar Galactica, right? You know, that he was just waiting for some Bob Dylan music, right? And I know who I am now, right? Now, of course, all that's completely ridiculous, right? On one hand. I mean, how is it possible that anybody could possibly think that the Obama administration, which is not only prosecuting the war in Afghanistan, but has been escalating it, and by all accounts, the war in Afghanistan, the humanitarian crisis, the death toll is escalating. I saw one thing from the London Times Online that said nearly 1 million refugees are being created as a result of the new American bombing campaign on the Afghan-Pakistan border. I mean, this is just a horrible humanitarian crisis. One question that came up last night was the idea of, well, since Obama is president, would you think that that will mean that there will be greater support for the occupation of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan? And I think for some people that might be true. I mean, I think that there's always been a question in my mind for the last decade of how much of the anti-war sentiment was first and foremost anti-Bush sentiment. And I think what the polls show and what the activism shows is that overwhelmingly the American population not only wants the occupation of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan to come to an end, but they want the troops. They want the troops brought home, and of course they expect Barack Obama to do that. And that's one of the things, like when I disagree with John about, is that you have to have a feel for the dynamic of politics. Is that when you elect somebody with this so much sense that society is in crisis, that things have gone wrong for so long, that people have watched huge amounts of casualties and disabilities and just the disgusting way that American veterans have been treated. I mean, if people don't know some of this stuff, I'd be glad to answer questions about it. Very similar to Vietnam. I always take the issue of Vietnam very personally because my uncle fought in the war. He came back to a horrible Veterans Administration system that my mother, his sister, described as a living hell. And he got the two big whammies from Vietnam. He got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress and exposure to Agent Orange, and he would later kill him. That would later kill him from cancer. So the way that veterans are treated is a huge issue in the United States, and while they put some money under the Obama administration back into that, we can say, you know, it's just not enough. It really just isn't enough, and people want fundamental change. And I think the question then becomes out of that is, what are people prepared to do internationally about building a movement that will continue to struggle against the American wars and occupations in Afghanistan and in Iraq, where I think we can also safely say that the issue, you know, history hasn't stopped in Iraq. The Americans may have stabilized their position for the moment, but when you carry out and you kill millions of people and you occupy their country and you have a bunch of quislings running their country, that doesn't mean that the national struggle is over. It's just a question of where the national struggle among Iraqis is going to go from here. And I think we have to figure out how we're going to continue and support that struggle, despite the Obama presidency. I think there's two things, however, that we need to sort of talk about in terms of the broader impact of Obama and the world. And I think the first has to start with is, of course, the international economic crisis, which I think, you know, is not something that is going to be like the professionals tell us. You know, they're used to talking about how we have these recessions that last for 12 months, 14 months. Oh, it was a long recession. It's going to last 17 months, and then the recovery will start. I think we have to recognize that what's going on is historic, and of course, that is a word that is just bandied about. People use that phrase here, right? Bandied about way too much, and it demeans it a little bit. I think that if we talk about historic, it simply means one thing I think we can all agree on, which is the idea that life will be different afterwards for the vast majority of us. And in this case, life is going to get very difficult for the vast majority of us in the near future. Paul Krugman, who's one of the few Obama supporters, who's a well-known economist, has broken with much of the happy talk lately around signs of economic recovery and says that he can't even begin to imagine there to be an economic recovery in the United States until 2015. And I don't even want to tell you how old I will be in that year. That, however, is only the beginning of things. There's a much, along with this crisis, is, of course, the collapse of all of the lies that have justified the policies that have brought the world to the abyss during the last 30 years. And the bourgeois commentators have had to address them. I mean, Martin Wolf had a very long series called The Future of Capitalism in the Financial Times, where his opening line in his first column was, "Another God has failed." It's interesting how they always go back to gods on sort of things like this. I don't really quite, we're completely rational people. Only Americans talk about gods. One stockbroker after the markets crashed last year in the United States got up on CNN and said, "Our Berlin Wall has crumbled." I wouldn't have used those phrases, but these are, you know what I'm saying? You know, as a socialist, you know, you can be a little stiff in how your language, right? And then these people sort of, they go and they describe it in a way that actually is far more accurate in some ways. All the things that we have been told for 30 years that, you know, it's the free market, it's the CEOs, these are the people who know how to make money, they know how to develop societies, this is the way that you bring about freedom, democracy, and prosperity. And if you disagreed with any of that, you were a crank, a weirdo, the old left, old Europe, whatever that is. Europe's pretty old, you know. You're going to be part of new Europe. I'm not sure where Australia fits into that. Is that old Australia, new Australia? But all those sort of things, you know, like I was saying last night, that people should, if people want to get a good little taste of the stupid ideas that dominated the world the last three decades, read Thomas Frank's book, One Market Under God. He has the patience to sit down and actually go through all this stuff and put it into a book. But just a few things, you know, one of the best-selling books in the United States in the late 90s was called The Management Techniques of Attila the Hun. Who would buy a book like that? That's me. You know. You just wonder, right? You know, Attila's gone down pretty bad in history. That's why they're called Attila. Then there's like absurd ones like Jesus as CEO. Wait, what does that mean? I forgive you. Here's some bread. I don't know, you know. Sometimes you just wonder how these people think, right? And, of course, all the stuff that Washington did to impose its views on the world of this sort of stuff, you know, what they, the various things that they called it at one time, the Washington Consensus, whatever the hell that is. The consensus. You consent, right? You know, the American model. Right? That sounds a little bit more benign. I remember that there was, in the late 90s, when Clinton loved to get people in a room and just, he loved to talk about his ideas and how he felt your pain and how smart he was. He's like, I fucking miss him. When he was running for president in 92, they went down and talked to the head of the Arkansas Trade Union Congress. And they said, well, what's your opinion of Clinton? He said, well, you know, Bill, he's the type of guy who pats you on your back while he's pissing down your leg. And I thought, that's really good. I kind of remember that. You know? And of course, at one of those sessions where he had brought in all the Europeans and he was patting them on the back while he was pissing down their legs and telling them about the American model and you have to privatize and you have to, you know, keep the unions under wraps and you got to cut back on the public sector, one of the French delegates said, well, okay, but where should I go for dinner? He says, well, you don't really want to walk too far from the hotel because you might get robbed. And he said, hold it here. You know, you're telling us this is the model for everything, and yet my safety is at stake here in the capital of the country, right? So I think you got to look back to some of those things and just say, these are all the lies that have really collapsed. And, of course, one of the things that you have to say about the recent events is that even though, of course, they are completely directed, the bailout of the banks is completely directed at saving the rich and saving their institutions, is that it does change the whole contours of the political debate. Because we have been told, and I'm sure it's the same arguments here in Australia, is the reason you can't fund healthcare, the reason you can't expand education, the reason you can't have a decent transportation system. Look, I thought that public transit system was screwed up in Chicago. This Connex stuff here. They subsidize these guys to make a profit? Where the hell's capitalism there? I said, that's a scam worthy of Chicago. Yeah. I said, that's pretty wild, you know? That the fact that they have intervened in the economy on this level means that people no longer go, well, I guess I can't ask for it because there's no money. People go, well, clearly there's money. I mean, Bush's people initially said that there was $1 trillion they were going to spend on saving the banks. Now, I keep forgetting how many zeros that is. But now it's up to 3. I mean, I've never had to write it out, you know. It's not like in my checkbook I go, you know, I got to get those 9 zeros in there, right? 12. You know, 1. 12. Okay. It's been a long time since I've been in math class. But, you know, where you go, and now it's possibly going to be, credibly, up to $9 trillion. I mean, the scale of this intervention is that the numbers at some point lose meaning. I mean, I don't try to downplay that, but when you start talking like, you know, and that's when people like on public television who are the snooty liberals, they say, well, let's explain this to the masses, what $12 million, you know, $9 trillion is. So they'll say, that's like taking $1 bills and stringing them together from here to the moon, as if that helps. You know, as if I've walked to the moon and can really, I really identify that. I've walked in those shoes, you know. But, of course, this has really produced an incredible social catastrophe. Now, for a long time, there's been a slow-motion catastrophe in the United States, because I think one of the things that has been unique about the United States maybe in the last 35 years, and I know that we've all suffered this in any country that's seen employers' offensives and neoliberal parties in power, whether they're conservative or liberal or labor parties, is that we have seen, you know, real wages in the United States haven't increased since 1972. I mean, real wages. Most working class people survive the recoveries that take place by just working more. Americans, on average, work 3 weeks more a year than most people in European countries. The healthcare system, this is before the recession, is 50 million people did not have health care in any way. So these were the everyday social catastrophes in the United States before the beginning of this economic crisis. Over the last several months, John mentioned this in his presentation earlier, over 2.5 million jobs have just been completely lost in the United States. The New York Times reported about a month ago that American business, in their own words, is just shedding all types of operations. They're just dumping businesses and manufacturing and just getting out of it. Every month for the last 3 months, there's been a minimum of 600,000 jobs have disappeared from the economy, peaking at nearly 700,000 last month. This, of course, is on top of and running along with a huge explosion in the housing market. The foreclosure rates are just astronomical. In Cook County, which is where Chicago and the immediate suburbs are, the foreclosure rates are 300% higher than they were before the beginning of the recession. You can go down, which some newspapers, now that they're not controlled by Conrad Black and Murdoch, have actually gone down and done stories that newspaper reporters used to do, which is actually, let's go down to the bankruptcy court and let's see who's there. And when they have profiled people, they're usually almost always retirees, first and foremost. Second is people who have been laid off from their jobs, and others who have gone bankrupt because their medical costs have bankrupted them. This is how one crisis loops into another and just brings everything down. As you can probably guess, the biggest impact of this crisis is disproportionately on African Americans. In some cities in the United States, Chicago, Buffalo, I mean names that are well known to people, unemployment for black men between the ages of 16 and 45 reaches anywhere from 50 to 60% of the population. The housing crisis has resulted in the greatest transfer of wealth out of the black community. The black community, according to some advocacy groups, has lost $78 billion in the last 2 years. I mean, this is something that you can't, again, it's hard when it's just the numbers to get a grasp of. And of course, then how this then loops into the state budget deficit. So you have states like California, the largest in terms of population, over 36 million people live there. What was considered to be the American paradise, the American Riviera. Everybody wants to live in California, right? I mean, I grew up believing that. Now has a $20 billion deficit. It already is considered 48th in terms of 1 through 50 in terms of state funding for education, for primary school students. There are closings of hundreds of schools all over California, the healthcare system. I mean, it's just, you know, this is just what is taking place is historic in that way, and historic in a sense that it's people's lives are going to be completely different. Now, this historic crisis also coincides with, I think, an important understanding about the political shifts in the United States. As I said last night, the only reason you ever quote David Brooks from the New York Times is to show that even somebody who's a knucklehead like David Brooks gets it, is that he described Obama's election as the end of the economic era, an end of a political era, and the end of a generational era all at once. And what, to put it very simply, the conservative era and the way that we have understood it is over in that sense. That doesn't mean it's going to disappear tomorrow. That doesn't mean that while there's state intervention to save the economy right now, you're not going to, that means that automatically they're going to empty out the prisons and the wars. It just means that all of the ideas that have justified these type of policies have exhausted themselves. And I think it's important to recognize that while Obama is president of the Democratic Party, which, you know, as you grow up as a socialist in America, you learn everything you can about how rotten the Democratic Party is. And, of course, you know that because most people who become socialists are first and foremost Democrats. I mean, I was. I grew up in a Democratic Party family, you know, and if you ever criticize the Democratic Party publicly, you know, you would be told very simply, you know, the Democrats gave you health care, they gave you Social Security, they gave you unions, they gave you Medicare, and what did the Republicans ever do for you but screw you? Now, that used to be the line. Now, of course, over the last 30 years, it's been the Democrats taking away health care, education, union rights, and so forth. And, you know, while my mother, when she was still alive, would say, well, Joey, I agree with everything you say. I'm still going to vote for the Democrats, right? But it is important, I think, to recognize that you have the election of the first African-American president of the United States. And what does that signify? That shouldn't distract from the fact that a whole, you know, grouping of absolutely horrible people wanted Barack Obama to be president of the United States. I mean, when you got Colin Powell, Mayor Daley, and Rupert Murdoch pushing you, you got to say there's an agenda here, right? And clearly the agenda is very straightforward. George Bush did a lot of damage to American imperialism, right? He did a lot of damage to the credibility of American power around the world, and he needlessly, in their eyes, alienated the people that they need to actually run the world. That's why you find the Democrats so furious at the Republicans, not because they don't have the same project, but because they really tore up everything that Clinton achieved in the 1990s. But it's also important to recognize, I think, that a country which, except for certain periods of times, particularly in the 60s and 1970s, and that's why the right wing hates the 60s and the 70s so much, and they spend so much time attacking it, is that American politics has always been based on and organized around the worst type of racism and race baiting. And it does show, I think, a significant change in the attitudes of many people when they vote for a black man for president. The question is where does it go from there, right? Does this, as it should, lead to more the ability to organize black and white and Latino workers, or does it just become an empty gesture? And I think none of us are for an empty gesture. It's also, I mean, just to make it personal, my father would have never voted for a black man for president. It just would not have happened. It just would not have happened. It's also important to recognize that in the presidential campaign, the Republicans did everything they could to race bait Obama during the presidency, and it didn't work. And you have to say that also represents an important change in people's political attitudes. They attacked him as a secret Muslim. He looked foreign. Doesn't everybody in the United States look foreign? I mean, we're all from somewhere else, you know. A Marxist. I remember on Fox News one of these mornings, they brought Joe Biden, who is the senator from Delaware. And the only thing you should ever know about Delaware, right, is that that's where every major corporation incorporates itself, because it's a corporate state, Delaware, right? Particularly the credit card companies. In fact, what Joe Biden was known for, up until he started running for vice president and became respectable, was that he was the senator from the credit card companies. He was the guy who presided over the revision of the bankruptcy laws to make it easier for people, for the companies, to actually get money out of you if you filed for bankruptcy. That's who Joe Biden is. They had him on Fox News, and they read out a long quote. I was like, am I really watching? I mean, we all know Fox News is not really news, but, you know. They read out this long quote from the Communist Manifesto, you know? You know, to each according to their needs, from each according to their abilities. And I'm like, where is this conversation going? And Biden's there, and he's like waiting for the question, you know, because it's not very often the vice, you know, president gets read a long quote from the Communist Manifesto. Well, this is what Karl Marx said. And Obama said he was for redistributing the wealth, therefore Obama's a Marxist, right? And Biden's like, what are you talking about? I mean, this is weird, right? I mean, I hope that there's all sorts of things from the neoliberal era that come to an end. One of them is Fox News. You know? The other is that we could just go back to calling spaghetti spaghetti instead of pasta. That's my own personal thing. And you can just have coffee instead of cappuccino, but that's my own little thing. And, of course, he was unrelentingly attacked from the Republican right for being a defeatist. This is the man who wants to pull up the tents of American power and come home and allow the crazy Muslims to win in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, that's what they said openly. And the fact that Obama won a sizable majority against that type of political onslaught is not to disguise what Obama's about. It's important to show the broader change in people's political attitudes. And it's from this, I think, that, you know, expectation of change, the sort of end of the conservative era, that really is where you get the combustible atmosphere that I think exists around politics right now in the United States. And I think the implications for this stuff are worldwide. After all, we're so used to the United States, I mean, particularly in the United States. You want to meet an elitist, you don't have to go outside of the United States to find somebody who'll say something bad about Americans. Just go to most Americans. All these people will never change, they'll never do anything, right? You find that in the labor movement, particularly among shop stewards. Oh, you know, I'd go out and strike tomorrow, but my guys, they'll never do anything, right? I mean, that's fine. Everybody complains about each other, right? Is that for 35 years, the United States has just been seen as this right-wing ice cube, right? Nothing ever changes. It's the thing that kind of sits on all of our backs. And I think that really these type of political issues are going to work their way out from the U.S. And I think this combustible atmosphere has already shown itself to be true in a couple of areas. And here's just a few examples. Soon after the Proposition 8, which withdrew the right to gay marriage in California, basically there was an explosion of younger gays and lesbians and supporters on the streets all over California and actually across the country. We had a demonstration of a couple of thousand people in the snow in Chicago against what happened with Proposition 8. And when the news reporters went up and interviewed people on the streets and said, well, you lost the vote, why are you doing this? And one guy said, well, history is on our side. One woman in San Francisco said, well, Obama was elected. I'm not a freak anymore. I think we can win. I think we can win things. And probably the best one was a young guy sitting on the in front of a blocking traffic with hundreds of other people. That's one thing Americans do. If you really want to have an impact, you block traffic. Right? Because everybody drives everywhere, right? He said, well, I thought that blocking traffic was less of a problem than having my civil rights taken away. And I think that kind of, you feel that kind of sense that we want fundamental change. Soon after the election of Obama, a month later, at the largest pork processing plant in the world in Smithfield, North Carolina, a really horrible place to work. It's cold, it's miserable, high turnover rate, long history of using racism to divide people. It had raids from Homeland Security against immigrant workers. There were three failed attempts at organizing the plant, and they finally won the vote to have the food and commercial workers represent them. They went up to one of the organizers and said, well, why do you think you won this time as opposed to the other times? And she said, well, I feel that if we could change the White House, we could change the Hog House. And I think that is a sense of people's rising expectations. And I think the other is simply the response to Gaza, is that it has been really remarkable that for, you know, just a few years ago when Arabs and Muslims, and particularly Palestinians, would find it impossible to really demonstrate with some confidence on the streets of the United States, communities that were just besieged by the FBI, by Homeland Security, that you saw thousands of people, Arabs, Muslims, and Palestinians, and supporters come out and very confidently and brazenly take on the issue of Gaza in all the major cities of the United States, taking Obama's campaign slogan of yes we can on massive posters saying yes we can end the siege of Gaza. And I think all of these things represent, you know, really the combustible atmosphere and the need for big change. Now, having said all that, we also have to recognize that we have powerful enemies, they have strong institutions, and we've also come into a situation where many of the institutions of the past that used to be the forms of resistance have been terribly weakened. The American Union movement is very weak. I don't know what it's like in Australia, but, you know, the private sector in the United States, only 8% of workers are in unions. You know, there has not been for a very long time anything approaching a civil rights movement in the United States. One of the biggest advocates for prison reform when Obama got elected said he was very optimistic about Obama's election because, after all, if the president and the attorney general are black, maybe we can get millions of young black men who are in prison in the United States for nonviolent crimes, maybe finally reform some of this and get a generation of young people out of jail. And Obama hasn't spoken about any of these things. What all this points to is the importance of building a political organization, a socialist alternative, and movements independent of the Democratic Party. Because I think the one thing that John pointed out in the last session that's absolutely true is that if you are beholden to these people, if you are part of their operations, they will use you to run you simply into the ground. The one way that has always been used to describe the Democratic Party in the United States is that it was the graveyard of social movements. That is that once you went from being a militant movement on the streets and in the workplaces to being campaign appendages of the Democratic Party, that's where you went to die and to be ineffective. And I think that, you know, the possibility of that movement being rebuilt is better now than it has been in a very long time. When I was at an event a few weeks ago, we sponsored a debate called The Left and Obama and had some of the representatives of some of the best-known journals on the left speaking. It was a good turnout, a good discussion. And this young woman just came up to me afterwards and said, well, you know, I listened to the debate tonight. I want to do something positive. I want to join a socialist group. And I thought to myself, now that is a generational change. Because for many of us who have been fighting to build a socialist alternative for the last 30 years, we have our scars, we have our bruises, and we have, you know, expectations that are sometimes lower than the rest of the population. We are now entering an era, I think, in which people's not only expectations are greater, but they expect more from change in the United States to make change possible throughout the world. So I leave you with that, that there's good news from the United States, not to underestimate the difficulties ahead, but I think we're at the very beginning of the change that we've been waiting for a long time in the United States, and I think the impact of that around the globe will only be positive for all of us. So thanks, everybody. Thank you.